Each community comes to a point where things happen in that community. There are major challenges. And so therefore, that community then has to assess where it's going, how it deals with that issue, so that you have to ensure that the whole community doesn't get tainted by the negativity caused by the very few.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. Today, my guest is Concetta Fierravanti-Wells, the Liberal Senator. Now, until all of that leadership nastiness, shall we call it that, she was the minister overseeing Australia's relationship with the Pacific. In the conversation coming up, you're about to hear what she thinks of Scott Morrison's Pacific pivot. Bit of a spoiler alert. She's got some issues. We're also going to talk relations with the Muslim community at a very sensitive time. She's got some interesting thoughts there. And I also grab her thoughts on this rolling Israel embassy controversy. Listen up. Connie, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be here, Catherine.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about the Pacific, which is now very much in dispatches because of some recent policy decisions by the government. But there's been a long, slow build-up to this, hasn't there? This sort of in this pivot.
There has.
So tell me about that.
When Malcolm Turnbull became Prime Minister, he actually established the Pacific as a ministry, and Stephen Chobo became Minister for International Development in the Pacific, which I think was really important because what it did is it placed the Pacific in a ministry before it had been a parliamentary secretary role. And having spent a lot of time in the multicultural space, and indeed this was one of the reasons why Malcolm, when he rang me and said, look, would you like to do this? Given your background, it was really valuable because I'd had connections, obviously, with some of those communities in the past and understanding very much the cultural diversity component of it as I had over many, many years' involvement. It really enabled me to do the very important part about this job, which is the relationships, to build those very personal relationships, because the Pacific, we talk about the Pacific family, but it is all about relationships. It's about the Talanoa. It's about sitting there. It's about sitting, talking. It's about understanding. It's about respect. It's many of the key people, the leaders in the Pacific, are people who have been there for a long, long time, senior figures in the Pacific. So it was really important to understand all of that, but also understand how important discussion and respect of cultural differences, respect of the way things are done. Yeah. And that was really important. So I spent a lot of time, Catherine, travelling around the Pacific. I did about 35 trips to the Pacific, mostly on commercial, which brought home to me a very important point, which is the challenges that our Pacific Island countries face, particularly in getting not just around but to each other. And so, therefore, when they do come together, as they do at the Pacific Island Forum and other forums, it's very much that time to exchange. It's very much that time to speak. So, to answer your question, there was a lot of lead up to this. And my role was basically to reposition the Pacific in the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. I saw very early how important the Pacific was for a whole range of geopolitical and strategic reasons. And having had a husband who served in the Royal Australian Navy for many years and, of course, at times spent a lot of time in the Pacific, I really understood from that strategic military naval history perspective just how important the Pacific was to our history and why it still mattered. And that was really my sort of thinking behind a lot of what I did. So I worked very hard in terms of understanding those issues and saying the Pacific is really important. We need to focus more of our ODA in the Pacific, but we also have to ensure that the Pacific is one of our key priorities, which I'm really pleased ended up being one of our key priorities in the foreign policy white paper.
Yes. And obviously the backdrop to all of this is China's rise in the region. This subject can't be avoided. And Australia created some circumstances. Now, you may disagree with me about what the analysis I'm about to bowl up, but Australia cut aid
early in the piece that did create opportunities for competitors to Australia in the region to assert their hegemonic instincts, right, to step into the region and be a friend, in inverted commas. It's opened the way for China's rise in the region, in my view. Do you have the same view? And
Catherine, I think it was a combination of factors. I think one of the, leaving aside the kind of infrastructure component of all of that, from Australia's perspective, I think one of the decisions that is very regrettable was the cut to our broadcasting services out into the Pacific. I think that that was a bad decision, and one which I think that now we're kind of scrambling to reposition. I mean, we have to remember that the Pacific, many of our Pacific Island countries have very strong ties to Australia. I mean, when one looks at our sporting arena, how many sports do we have when we have such a strong involvement? The work, the Pacific Labour Scheme, which has been very good. When we've had lots and lots of things that we've done, but I think that one of the issues was that there was not a proper coordination of a lot of those things. And when we started to actually look at all the things that we do in the Pacific, there is a lot. And Australia's focus in the Pacific has been very much on those day-to-day things that touch Pacific Island communities, health, education, those sort of things, governance, which are the day-to-day things which formed the basis of a lot of our aid partnership agreements. Mm-hmm. Now, whilst there was potentially some infrastructure component of that, it was very much part of a much broader picture. So for that reason, I was really pleased that we raised our level of spending in the Pacific to $1.3 billion, which was a record spend. I personally believe that we should spend a lot more of our ODA in the Pacific. This is our backyard, Catherine. This is the part of the world that our allies expect us to look after and expect us to be more engaged in. And whilst it's important for Australia to have an international presence, I strongly believe that the Pacific is our neighbourhood, our backyard. When things happen, and we live in one of the most disaster-prone parts of the world, and when you have 7 of the 10 most disaster-prone countries in your region, then that's very much a focus of where you put your attention. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I strongly pushed for a greater involvement by Australia in a range of different areas in the Pacific, and I'm really pleased that this step up was happening and was in the process, and now we're seeing the various components of it emerging. Now, some of those components I think are very good. I do have some reservations about some of them, which are...
Like?
Well, I did express some concerns. Infrastructure, of course, is really an issue, and it just goes to the very point that you were making earlier about China. Mm. Now, Australia's assistance to the Pacific is in the form of grants, and the Lowy Institute has done a Pacific mapping exercise where they've gone in and had a look at about 13,000 projects by about 60 or so development donors in the Pacific, and done an analysis of it. And of course, Australia remains by far the largest donor in the Pacific. However, China gives its aid by way of loans, and about 70% of China's assistance is by way of loans. Now, we know in the Pacific that we think there's about $5.5 billion worth of debt, and about $1.5 billion of that is owed to China. Mm-hmm. And when you have external debt to GDP ratios that go between 25 and 90%, Catherine, they're very high levels.
Yes.
Very high levels. Now, when you combine that with small formal economies and vulnerability as a consequence of climate events and disaster preparedness, you see a picture.
Yeah.
And that means, therefore, that the higher the debt, and when those debts, a debt is a debt is a debt, and that has to be repaid. And so we are now seeing this with Tonga, that if that debt is not forgiven, and that debt that they have, for example, to China, hasn't been forgiven, then that debt has to be repaid. And whilst Tonga has been in a situation where its debts to China have been deferred for a period of time, now they're due. And so that means that decisions have to be made by that country in terms of how it uses its scarce resources. And so when you have to pay your debt, as you do, you and I and anybody else has got a debt, you have to then think, well, hang on a moment, what am I going to sacrifice to be able to pay that debt?
So when we, because obviously the Prime Minister is last week, I think it was, the weeks kind of blend into one another really, but I think it was last week that he unveiled this infrastructure facility for the Pacific, which is loans. It's not grants, it's loans.
Well, this goes to my point. And I've been critical and indeed I made some comments at the beginning of the year in relation to infrastructure and Chinese infrastructure. And having spent, as I said, you know, I've done 35 trips to the Pacific. Some of those were to places that other ministers had never gone to. So I have seen for myself some of this infrastructure that has been built. So my point is this, I've been consistent on this issue. My concern is about the debt and debt distress. And so therefore, I have been an advocate of what the Pacific has been pursuing, and that is climate and disaster preparedness are the key priorities for the Pacific. And the Pacific Island Forum a couple of years ago, when Prime Minister Turnbull was there representing us, passed a resolution that they would establish a disaster preparedness framework, framework for resilient development and disaster preparedness. A key component of that was a disaster resilience fund. In other words, a fund. And there are funds like this similar around the world where Pacific Island countries could go to that fund and obtain loans at very concessional levels, but to do very basic sort of stuff, Catherine, to climate-proof the school, the community hall, the hospital. Mm. Often that would not be a large sum of money. And the reason why there is a push for this fund and very much sponsored by the Pacific and the Pacific Island Forum and its Secretary General is that it's independent, it's transparent, and it is not money owed to one particular country. Mm. And so that way you step back from the sort of debt concerns that I have raised and others have raised as well, and debt being owed to a particular country. Mm-hmm. So I have advocated for Australia to be one of the countries to be part of the initial capitalisation of this fund, and it needs about $1.5 billion. Mm-hmm. And so the point of the article that I wrote and some of the comments that I have made recently is to say, look, it's all very well to look at infrastructure, and that's very important, you know, sea cables and all those other things. But at the village level, the things that really matter is the school, the community hall, the little hospital, because if they can't withstand the next cyclone or the next storm, then for that village or that community, it's really hard to pick themselves up after that storm if that school is not climate-proofed to the point that it's not going to fall down in the next cyclone. So, regrettably, we have a situation, Catherine, where often the multilateral banks will wait for the school to fall down and then they'll fund the reconstruction. So, let's step back a bit. Isn't it more cost-effective and better for a country to say, look, I need a couple of million dollars to climate-proof my key infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's really the point that I'm making. So that is the key priority in the Pacific. And so therefore, I think that if we are going to set aside monies for infrastructure, that's the sort of infrastructure that should be given priority. So I would invite the government to consider a large contribution from Australia. If we really want to get out there and show how committed we are to the Pacific, given the climate challenges that it faces and given the disaster necessities in terms of being prepared, then a good thing would be for us to put in a large sum, whether it's $500 million or any other large sum, to help that capitalisation and then in turn encourage other donors, Japan, China, the EU, Britain, or any other donor around the world who wants to help the Pacific, particularly in terms of climate and disaster preparedness, to help with that capitalisation as well. So that's really where I'm going in all of this. Now, the other component to the announcement was the $1 billion for EFIC. Now, one of the challenges that we face in the Pacific is the fact that private sector investment is very difficult for obvious reasons. But having the ability for EFIC to be able to have callable capital there so that a private enterprise that may wish to invest, that may wish to be entrepreneurial and may wish to invest in the Pacific would have the backing of EFIC to do that. So it's sort of a bit like a it's a support for that business to go in. The business is going in, it's investing, it's getting the backing of EFIC to go in there. But it's private sector. It's not the country incurring the debt. So having been critical and raised concerns in relation to debt earlier in the year, and can I say, Catherine, that quite a number of people have thanked me for having raised that, because what that did is then lead to an international debate about debt and what's happening around the world. And people perhaps who didn't feel comfortable raising it in the Pacific then could do
felt
so.
They could because you
because,
had.
Because I did. And having been critical, I have to be consistent to say what we don't want is Australia potentially undertaking an initiative that could add to those debt levels.
But just to be clear, in terms of what you're saying, I get that it should be multilateral. Your idea is that it should be multilateral rather than Australia going in with, you know, sound the trumpet, here's our initiative, right? I get the multilateral dimension and why that makes sense politically. I'm a little bit confused because you're obviously concerned about the debt levels in the Pacific. Are you saying that Australia should give grants, not loans?
Well, I think that grants have worked. And I think that grants, because grants enable us to target very much at the levels, at the programs, at the necessities as part of a framework that we have adopted, which are aid partnership agreements. Now, I appreciate and I understand the necessity for infrastructure spending. The reality is, Catherine, that there are different levels of infrastructure. My point is, by all means, let's consider infrastructure.
Yeah.
The big stuff. The big stuff.
Yeah.
But it's the little stuff
That actually makes the difference.
And particularly, as the Prime Minister recently said, that we have, you know, climate and disaster preparedness are the key issues. And I agree with that. And indeed, that's the priority for the Pacific Island Forum itself. That's why I think this fund is important to the Pacific and is something that we, as the largest donor in the Pacific, should be thinking about, because that capitalisation, $1.5 billion is a lot of money, but capitalising that fund will then ensure its viability and its sustainability over a long period of time, and therefore enable countries to go to it, get small concessional loans, but actually be doing the small stuff. And some of it could be bigger stuff, but the point is it's the small stuff now that's really important.
And so we've sort of stumped up the $3 billion for the infrastructure fund, but we haven't done the other fund. Is that the issue?
I'm not sure here because I haven't seen the detail of it. I think the $1 billion to EFIC is good because basically it effectively means that a business will go in and do an investment, but underwritten and supported and basically guaranteed with the backing of the Commonwealth. So that's a separate issue. And that could mean, for example, that you might have a terminal that might need to be built at an airport or something like that. So an Australian company might go in, do the building, come to some arrangement with that government and say, okay, we'll build it, we'll run it for 20 years, and then at the end of it there's an option to do something else with it. But that's a different commercial arrangement that doesn't put a long debt on that particular country, but it does allow for a particular company that might build airport terminals, for example, to go in and do something of that nature.
Yeah.
So, And as for the $2 billion, I haven't seen what the detail of this is. But because it is a loan facility, I am concerned. Mm. I don't want to see a situation where one debtor is swapped for another debtor.
Yeah. No.
I mean, if I can put it in those simple terms.
Yeah. No, it can't
and
be clearer.
I'm just raising that. And given the fact that debt and debt sustainability is now very much a concern of not just the international community, the IMF and the banks, the multilateral banks, but the Pacific Island Forum itself.
Mm, exactly.
This is an initiative where the Pacific can help itself. Mm. And therefore, they want to do this. We have to help them to help themselves. And this is really what it's about.
Perfectly clear. Now you gave a sideswipe to one of your colleagues this week, Melissa Price, who had an unfortunate incident in a Canberra restaurant, of which she's given, in fairness to her, slightly confusing accounts that she's disputed what she said and also can't remember what she said. But anyway, let's not get bogged down in that. You described her as an L-plate minister. She said in a radio interview she was going to ring you up and give you a serve. Did she do that?
She left a message.
So you've not spoken to her?
No.
Do you stand by the analysis?
Catherine, the concern that I have is that we've done a lot of good work in the Pacific, and particularly in the climate area. And I know that there are different views about climate and climate change, etc. But the reality of the Pacific, irrespective of what your views are, that we have to deal with the reality. And the reality is there will be another cyclone, there'll be another storm, there'll be another storm surge, and low-lying islands will always be affected. And so therefore, for me, it's been the work that we've done. And what I didn't want is a circumstance where the hard work that we've done, the good work that we've done, and let's not forget, as part of our commitment to the Paris Agreement, $300 million of that $1 billion was directed towards the
Climate Fund.
$200 million went to the Green Climate Fund, of which for a period of time we were the co-chair, and we worked very hard to ensure that about 11% of the projects went to the Pacific. So that was separate. And then there was another $300 million, which was dedicated to climate-related issues in the Pacific, building resilience, building preparedness, disaster preparedness. And through that, we did some really, really good work.
So we've done all this stuff.
And what I didn't want is that good work being distracted from or trivialised as a consequence of this issue. And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay. You'll ring it back, though, presumably at some point.
Well,
possibly. Anyway, let's move on. There's another topic I want to engage you on because you wrote a very interesting piece earlier in the year, which was a contribution to a reboot of the Menzies collection of essays. A bunch of you wrote stuff. You wrote a piece about Muslim Australians that I wrote a piece about in The Guardian, and I think is a very good piece. So obviously this is a big issue now in the wake of the horrible incident in Bourke Street recently. You said in the essay that you wrote that you believe that Muslim Australians were at a crossroads that other immigrant groups had been in at previous times in Australian history. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is, having spent many, many years in the multicultural space, you've watched it over the years. Like in Australia's history, different communities have come at different times. And each of those communities has a period of time it takes for them to settle into the country. And let me take my own. I'm of Italian heritage. The bulk of the migration to Australia was post-war. And it took quite a number of decades for the Italian community to integrate, to establish itself. But there were periods during that time, particularly in the 1980s and following the killing of Donald Mackay and all of those issues. Mm. So my point is this, every community, and whether it's, we saw it with the Triads, we saw it with other communities, we saw it with Greeks, and there was the issue of the Greek conspiracy case and all of those things, each community comes to a point where things happen in that community. There are major challenges. And so therefore, that community then has to assess where it's going, how it deals with that issue, so that you have to ensure that the whole community doesn't get tainted by the negativity caused by the very few. And I see that what's happening with the Muslim communities, and I say communities because there are lots of diverse Muslim communities, different parts of Islam, different components of the Muslim faith, and of course they come from different parts of the world as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just from the Middle East. There are Muslim communities here from many, many different parts of the world. And so this is a similar situation. Similar in the sense that they too now have to deal with this major issue in their community and not let the actions of a few detract from the contribution of the broader Muslim communities to Australia. And therefore, in my piece, I made the strong point, as I have throughout, is that it is a responsibility of the community to own the problem, to own the issue, to recognise that there's a problem, but also deal with the consequences of that problem. And when I was parliamentary secretary to three ministers, the attorney, social services and immigration, I spent a lot of time going around to community, Muslim communities. There's about 160 Muslim organisations in Australia. I wrote to each one of them and then embarked on a series of consultations. So I travelled around Australia and I went to visit many, many of them in their mosques, in their associations. Some of them were used to run their operations from very small places, some from large mosques. But I was really able to get a very strong sense about how each one of them was dealing with these issues. So that really is the point. This has to come from within, and whichever way you say it, whether you say it in more strident language, Catherine, or whether you say it in this particular way, it's the same basic point, and that is that those people who are close to those young people in those communities, I believe, have a responsibility to understand they are the first responders. They are the ones that see firsthand the change in a young person and are the ones then that I think it's important for them to understand that the responsibility is on them to take the appropriate action to see what this is about or to deal with a particular issue. Because in the end, having been a former chair of Father Chris Riley Youth Off the Streets, young people go off the rails for all sorts of reasons, Catherine, whether it be for, you know, there's an issue at home or whatever the issue is. But at that most vulnerable point, that is when they are most vulnerable to be preyed upon.
Yes. Well, I was going to pick. Can I pick you up there?
Sure.
Because that is your argument that it needs to. The community needs to take responsibility and in essence deal with its own challenges, which is a point that Ed Husain has made in a deeply fascinating book about his own radicalisation in Britain before coming back. But a point that you acknowledged in your essay, which not some of your colleagues, with due respect to them, don't, is that Muslim Australians suffer prejudice and that that can isolate people, which can sow even further these seeds of radicalisation. So that's a very complex problem to deal with.
It is a very complex problem. And, of course, having grown up, as I have, in diversity, I mean, it goes back to the point that I made earlier. When the Italians and the Greeks first came out to Australia, you know, we were wogs and dagos. I mean, it's just something that's a part of our history. It's a part of life. Now, you either get on with it and you just, you know, move on or whatever. But it is a very complex issue. And as I go back to the point that I made just a little while ago, young people can go off the rails for a whole range of different things and various different things can trigger it. And I have to say that today's young people face a much more challenging time because the potentials out there to affect them are far greater than, Catherine, perhaps when you and I were growing up, given our age.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that is, you know, very, very much the case. And I think that it has to be recognised.
Are you concerned, because there are a number of groups, you know, with a fragmentation of the political system in Australia, and even groups within the major parties that look for populist, simplistic, short, sharp, horrible, reductionist, you know, presentations of very, very complicated societal issues. We're obviously, we're in the middle of a state election in Victoria. Yeah. We're heading for a federal election in New South Wales. We're heading for a state election in New South Wales, a federal election. Are you concerned that we are gearing up for some, I close my eyes and sort of, I can't quite articulate what I mean, but some, you know, very divisive, loaded, explosive conversation about these issues, or am I just having night terrors?
Look, I think that there are genuine issues and there are genuine concerns. And I think that this issue has evolved in the last few years, and there are regrettably And I have had people of Muslim faith say this to me directly, that there are people, and there is now an understanding and an admission that there are some components of, you know, radical elements in this country, and the Muslim communities themselves know that because they are now being all branded together. So it goes back to the point that I made before. That's why it's really important that the Muslim communities themselves deal with these issues. Now, this is a complex issue because it potentially pits one part of those communities against the other. And we know that this has its history, and it's a very, very long history. But Catherine, that is the reality, and I think that that's potentially where this issue will need to go. There are going to have to be elements in the Muslim communities, and we refer to them often as the moderate elements, which is the overwhelming majority, in my experience, of our Muslim communities, you know, have gone about their business for centuries in this country. I mean, let's not forget that
Afghan traders,
and even before that, you had up north, you just have to go down to the Islamic Museum in Melbourne to have a look at the history of the presence of Muslims here in Australia. But again, it comes to that point, and my sense is that it's really only going to have to be the leadership. And because the leadership of the Muslim community is so diverse, there's a degree, and I have myself advocated this to various people, there is a need for far greater unity not only understanding of the problem, of recognition of the problem, but also a broader plan of action and owning the problem and coming together, even though there may be major differences, but come together and say, listen, if we don't deal with this issue, the whole community is going to be tainted.
Do you think it sort of diffuses, I think you're being a bit too diplomatic to say, do you think it diffuses the rancid politics if the community itself stands up and makes a strong statement about recognition of its own problem and, you know, do you think it diffuses the rancid politics?
Well, I basically raised this few years ago, Catherine. I mean, I've been talking about this for quite some time, I think it's getting to the point where the communities are now, I think the situation for them now is more drastic than it was, say, a number of years ago, because there are much more inculcated views in our society about these issues. And so therefore, I think that it's becoming more pressing for those communities to take decisive action to ensure, as I said before, that the legacy the legacy or our migration legacy, because this is not just an issue about migration. It's actually a much broader issue about Muslim communities. Mm. It's a much broader issue about the legacy of immigration to this country.
Of course.
And we are a migrant country. I mean, since World War II, 7.5 million people have come to this country, and that includes about 850,000 under our humanitarian program. So we are a migrant country. Migration was a feature of our past, our present, it will be in the future. But what we cannot do is let this issue taint the broader
legacy. Take it all hostage.
And this is the other issue, because we've got a strong interfaith work in Australia. So interactions are occurring at different levels. I think the time has come where the pressures are certainly there on the Muslim communities, and they're there at different levels. And my sense is that this is an issue that is becoming more pressing. The other issue that a lot of Australians don't understand is that according to the census, about 60% of people who profess to be of Muslim faith are actually born here in Australia.
Mm.
And it's and they're quite young. So, you know, they're sort of, around the sort of, I think that figure of 60 is about age between 16 and 30 or something. Mm. I'm just sort of going back a little bit
on that
one. But it gives you the sense that a greater portion. So when people say, oh, we should send them back, well, the reality is that the overwhelming majority of people born here in Australia, and therefore they have Australian citizenship.
Yes,
and therefore it is not an issue that is as simplistic as saying send them back from whence they came, because they're Australian. They were born here.
Mm.
And so therefore it is an issue that they are Australian, and therefore the important thing is that they need to feel fully part of this Australian. I mean, I was born here. When I went to school, I didn't speak a word of English.
Mm.
And today I sit here in the Senate. But the important thing is that each one of those young people who was born in this country needs to feel that they have equal opportunity, because as a country that professes to say, you know, we have freedom of religion, we have freedoms to do all sorts of things, and therefore it's important that young people aren't prejudiced against when they do want to do things.
Yes.
And it's actually interesting, when I was doing this work, I attended a dinner, and it was in Melbourne, and this person came and said, look, I'd really like you to speak to my son. And I did, and this young man had been done very, very well at his school. He'd done exceptionally well at school. He'd then went on to university and did very, very well, got a university degree and started to apply for jobs. And he applied. He told me he'd applied for about 30 jobs and hadn't got anywhere. And he went to see an employment consultant who suggested to him that if he changed his name, he would probably fare better. And so he submitted an application to one of the places under a different name, anglicised name, and was offered the job.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Now, that was just a little story, and I share that because that is happening in Australia. That is happening. And I cover some of those issues in the essay that that I wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just a couple of political things quickly, because you are in the politics of business, and so am I, and they can't be avoided. Now, we're a couple of months on from the leadership change. Does that seem like a good idea?
Well, that was a decision of the party room. I mean, the reality is that there was a vote of 45 to 40 for the spill, and Peter Dutton wasn't successful. But I think mathematics tells you that there were five people who voted for Mr. Morrison who also voted for the spill. So
strange that.
And you know, that's where we are at the moment. And look, I think that we certainly have challenges. And we certainly saw that in Wentworth. But all we can really do now is to do the best that we can to put forward to the Australian public what we believe in, how, you know, the economy is doing well. By all accounts, you know, we have a good story to tell. We have a good narrative to tell. And lots of people have gotten into jobs and feel that we are doing a good job. The important thing is that we sell that message and sell that message effectively.
A bit hard, though, with the weighted by, you know, three leadership changes in two terms. Yes, anyway, we'll, it's the look on Connie's face is enough, really. The embassy in Israel has been a big issue this week. I'm interested in your view. Scott Morrison came out in the context of the Wentworth by-election and said, we're going to do what Donald Trump did in the Middle East. That floated out as a thought bubble, and there's been some consequences associated with it. Is this an idea you support?
Well, this was a decision, actually, a motion passed at our federal council, and I personally agree with it. It was a decision that was clearly made in a particular context, and the Prime Minister indicated that it would be something that we would look at. Whether we now go through with it is obviously a matter for the leadership, or I'm not sure how this is now going to be resolved.
Is going to be resolved.
But let me come at this from another angle. Catherine, we put out there last year a foreign policy white paper that professes to be a projection of our values and beliefs. And we set out in that white paper the things that we believe in and the things that motivate and underpin our foreign policy, the freedoms and freedom of speech and freedom of international rules-based order, all of those things. So I think in the end, for us, when we do consider what is in the national interest, you also have to think that if you're going to go out there and profess a foreign policy white paper which says that our foreign policy is a projection of our values, then in fairness to the Australian public, you have to abide by that. And whether that means in a future consideration about what we may do in different parts of the world, in different areas where we may be asked to undertake, and whether it's in the South China Sea, and I'm a strong proponent of freedom of navigation exercises and respecting the rules-based international order, the reality is that if you're going to do that and you're going to have a values-based foreign policy paper, then you need to do that in the national interest, taking into account, yes, commercial interests, but at the same time not being afraid of commercial impacts. You have to look at this from the broader perspective, by all means take into account commercial interests. But values are values, and if you hold a particular value and you tell the Australian public that you hold a particular value, then there comes a time when you're going to have to make decisions and consider your decisions within the context of those values.
So when you say commercial values, are you basically saying that the free trade deal with Indonesia is a reasonable, or the collapse of that, if that's where this ends, is a reasonable price to pay for Australia to articulate its values?
Well, the reality is that each decision, and I'm not in cabinet, so I'm not privy to a lot of the issues that they'll have to think about. But I think there's a degree of contestability that's necessary in this discussion. I mean, what you don't want is groupthink on these sort of issues. These are issues where there are different views across the Australian public. And what's very important is that when you do consider, whether it's this issue or any other issue, you have to think about the cross-section of views and make sure that that cross-section of views is considered at the decision-making time. And so that's why this is an issue where there are different opinions, and I would hope that our Cabinet will take those diverse views into account in making any decision.
But your own view is that you would support moving the embassy.
I do.
And you're sanguine about the consequences in terms of the region.
I do.
So it doesn't matter that it's...
Well, mine is a point of view. It's a point of view that's shared by others. And obviously it's a point of view that is balanced against other things in the national interest. But the important important thing is to make sure that you do take into account that there are those views. And as I said, Catherine, whether it's about the embassy in Israel or whether it's about what we might do in the South China Sea or whether it's what we might do in any other issue, there are always, diplomacy is a very complex issue, but the reality is that you have to balance the national interest. But to do that, you have to make sure that you do take into account and that there is a degree of contestability in that policy consideration, because ultimately you'll get a better decision
If
there's a variety of voices.
Yes. Okay. All right. It's a great chat, Connie. Thank you for it.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Good to be on your podcast.
Well, thank you again so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Hannah for production this week. Thank you too in advance for subscribing and sharing. In the event that you like the listening, don't forget to leave a rating or a review on iTunes, download via your favourite podcast app. Do subscribe, do share, does matter. And we'll be back with another show next week.